Hello, it's time for Health First. Alan Wishart in for Kathy Hart this week. Got a couple of great guests lined up, but we're going to get things started as usual with the Health First news.
The largest organization representing U.S. breast surgeons is issuing new screening guidelines advising women at average risk to begin annual mammograms at age 40. Those guidelines differ from advisories from the influential U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which moved first mammogram screenings from 40 to 50 years of age, as well as that of the American Cancer Society, which puts the starting age at 45. The American Society of Breast Surgeons says it based the new guidelines on a different model than that used by the Preventative Services Task Force. The new guidelines recommend all women undergo formal risk assessment by age 25. Screening based on specific risk factors is recommended for women with an increased risk of breast cancer. However, women with average risk should begin annual screening at age 40. Researchers say cases in which a newborn's genitals make it unclear whether the child is a boy or a girl may be more common than once believed. In some cases, infants have external sex organs that don't match their internal reproductive organs. For example, a female infant can have external sex organs that resemble male genitals but have typical internal female organs, ovaries, and a uterus. According to the study's first author, Dr. Banu Kuchikumre Aydın, a researcher at Istanbul University in Turkey, and her colleagues, in these so-called intersex cases, treatment may be delayed until puberty or adulthood so patients and doctors can make shared decisions. For their study, the researchers analyzed data on nearly 14,200 newborns. Of those, 18 had ambiguous genitalia. In a news release from the Endocrine Society, Aydın says that's a rate of 1.3 in 1,000 births, much higher than the rate of 1 in 4,500 to 5,500 reported in previous studies. Good news for men, a new study shows that blood pressure medicine you're taking might be doing double duty, helping reduce your risk of developing prostate cancer. Researchers found a beta blocker called atenolol cut men's risk of intermediate grade prostate cancer in about half. The findings showed it also appeared to significantly reduce the risk of low grade prostate cancer. However, the effect was only found in atenolol. Two other beta blockers, metoprolol and carvedilol, did not appear to provide any protection against prostate cancer. And finally, the sooner a child with autism is diagnosed, the better, and now new research describes a novel way of catching it earlier than ever. The study suggests well-child visits that include developmental screening might pick up the first hints of autism risk in some children. In the study, young children whose normal development started to slip behind that of other kids, a process called developmental deceleration, appeared to be more likely to be later diagnosed with autism. The researchers found about 20% of kids with declining developmental trajectory wound up diagnosed with autism, compared with just 2% of all children.
And that was the Health First news. And we have a phone call. We had not received a phone call yet from our expected first guest. Not our guest? No. Okay.
Do we want to wait? Because apparently he's going to try calling back again.
No.
But no.
Okay. Go to an interview Kathy Hart did earlier with Dr. Tamsin Astor on reduce your stress.
We have Dr. Tamsin Astor with us today. She has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience, and she uses that with yoga, Ayurveda, meditation, and coaching training to help us unleash our power through healthy habits. Welcome, Dr. Astor.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So you've authored a book called Force of Habit. How important are our habits to our wellness?
They're hugely important. About 40% of what we do every day are habits. And as we know from the addiction literature, once habits are in place, they're really hard to break. So making sure that the habits that you have serve the life that you want to lead is really, really important.
Yeah. And how long does it take to make a new habit?
Well, it really depends on the person and the habit. And it also depends on whether you're adding a new habit or whether you're replacing a habit. So, you know, the most important thing when you're adding a new habit is to be consistent. So, you know, doing it every day is more important than doing it, you know, once a week for 90 minutes.
Absolutely. To have that jump out of bed and this is what I do. So it's eventually it's not even thinking about doing it, just doing it.
Exactly. Like when we learn to drive a car, you know, when you first learn to drive a car, you think, you know, take off the park brake, look in the mirrors, you know, you think through all those steps. And after a while, you don't even think because they've all become automated.
That's right. So how do we get there when we have low energy and we're time deprived and there's all these good choices? How do we get from there to abundance and fun and using our habits wisely?
Well, the way that I describe it to my clients is that there's a sort of two-step process. There's the microscopic process of looking at the daily habits. When are you eating? What are you eating? When are you sleeping? When you're going to the gym or doing yoga or whatever. And then there's the sort of the telescopic approach, which is the stepping back and looking at the kind of life you want to lead. And when you get stuck in the, I don't want to get out of bed at 5 a.m. to go to the gym, if you take a moment to step back and think, well, you know, I want to be able to chase my grandkids along the Great Wall of China in 30 years' time, or, you know, I want to be able to have that energy so that I can find more clients today, or whatever it is that you are zoning in on as your, you know, goals for the kind of life you lead. When you take that approach, that can be really helpful in cultivating the energy for the habits that you may feel a little bit, not desirous of committing to on a daily basis.
Right. And what caused you to write the book?
So it was a personal experience. In 2008, my second child was diagnosed with cancer, and I developed insomnia and food allergies. And I found it frustrating that the Western doctor's approach to me not being able to sleep and being, you know, dysregulated was just to take pills. And I thought, you're suppressing my symptoms rather than trying to understand the context for why I have these symptoms. And so at this point, I started to study yoga, and I discovered Ayurveda. And when I get interested in something, I study it until I'm certified in it. And the more I started doing it and weaving it together with my background in psychology and neuroscience, the more it worked for me. And once it worked for me, I decided I had to share it with other people. And then in 2014, my marriage ended, and I committed to really focusing on developing my writing technique for blogging. And previously I'd been blogging, you know, saying things like, you know, meditate because it's good for your immune system, which nobody really cared about. But when I was going through my divorce, I started saying things like, when your four-year-old daughter is crying on your lap because she misses daddy's new girlfriend, meditate so you don't want to stick a fork in your eye. And people suddenly were engaging with me because
they got it.
Feeling, you know, my personal experience, you know, and going, I'm a human, I know what it's like to struggle, and here's a tool that you can use. And then the more I wrote, the more people reached out to me, and eventually three or four people who were in the writing, blogging, editorial business said, you need to write a book, you have an interesting voice. So that's how it came to be.
Wonderful. And how did the Ayurveda come into play? What did you benefit from that study?
How did the what?
From Ayurvedic principles.
The Ayurvedic principles are really interesting because they're about understanding your daily rituals and routines. One of the main components of Ayurveda is Dinacharya, which means your daily ritual. And it's looking at when you eat, when you sleep, you know, weaving in your self-care, taking time for self-massage, taking time to do yoga, taking time to meditate. And it's really woven in with, you know, what is the energy like outside? What is the energy like of the people you engage with? And really paying attention to that. So, for example, I live in Northeast Ohio, and we're moving into the winter. We're expecting our first snowstorm tonight. So, you know, eating strawberries at this time of year in Ohio is not me being in touch with my local environment, because they'll have to come, you know, from South America or somewhere else, you know, to feed me. So being in touch with your local environment, you know, being outside when the sun is out, being outside when the sun is setting to regulate melatonin levels. So that was really where it came from. It was this understanding, or my desire to understand and then follow these principles that have been around for 6,000 years. The other big component of Ayurveda is food. You know, we now know from psychoneuroendocrinological studies that the majority of the serotonin is in our gut, not in our brain, as, you know, as Big Pharma wants us to believe. And so what we eat massively affects how we feel. And Ayurveda is often called the kitchen science because, you know, often it starts with, what are you eating? What are you consuming?
Mm-hmm. And with that, is that, did you go vegan or vegetarian, or is it just whatever's local and whatever's nourishing?
So the main principles of Ayurveda are plant-based, but not strictly vegan. Often milk and ghee, which is clarified butter, are used. Hardcore protein, aka meat, is generally used in more of a therapeutic way, as in if you've gone through surgery or post-childbirth, or you've had some situation which has depleted your resources, your ojas, we call it in Ayurveda. That's the point when usually animal products are eaten. But, you know, eggs and milk and clarified butter are part of the diet. So one of the things that's great about Ayurveda is about figuring out what works for you. So I tried going vegan, and I discovered that I found eating a huge number of legumes, or a huge number of pulses and beans, really indigestible. Like, my body struggled to digest them. So I do better having, you know, a piece of fish every now and again, and an egg every now and again, but eating mainly a plant-based diet.
Okay. And so you put yoga, Ayurveda, meditation. Did you have meditation practice before 2012, before life got really stressful?
Yes, I did. I started doing meditation in 2008 when I did my first yoga teacher training. And then I started studying Buddhism and doing a regular meditation practice in around 2011. And then took refuge as a Buddhist in 2013.
Wow, sounds like you've had some very extensive, interesting training.
Yes, I am. When I get interested in something, I like to study it to the point of being certified or trained in it.
Wonderful.
my weakness, as it were.
I don't know if that's a weakness. And then how with your book, The Force of Habit, Unleashing Your Power Through Healthy Habits, do you think most people could just pick it up and use it, or is it... would you need a mentor to find a mentor as well?
Well, I wrote it as a sort of primer to starting to shift your habits, you know. So it lays out the five key habits that I think are important, and what I've noticed from having worked with clients for the last 5 years are really fundamental. So, you know, presenting some ideas around what is motivation and how do you motivate yourself, and then sleeping, eating, exercising, relationship with yourself and relationship with others. And then at the back of the book, there's a recipe book and some journaling questions. So most people do better having some kind of support network, whether it's a book club or, you know, a group that they work with, or having a coach. Because, you know, one of the things that, you know, we know in the coaching industry is that a lot of the work that we do with our clients, it's not, you know, whether it's a health coach or a love coach or a a physical trainer, we know what to do. It's just having somebody there going, well, are you showing up and doing the work? You know?
Right. Yeah. That's just keeping tabs on you, being accountable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so you've got those five keys: the motivation, sleeping, eating, exercise. What was the last one?
There's two, and then relationship with yourself. Oh. So that's kind of mindset, grit, resiliency. And then relationship with others. You know, do you have healthy boundaries? What kind of conversations are you having with the important people in your life?
Mm-hmm. And do you have coaching on how to engage in healthy conversation in there?
Yeah, so sometimes that comes up. Because one of the things that's interesting when people start changing their habits is they start changing who they are.
Right.
You know, if you start cutting out eating meat or going to bed early or meditating or adding exercise into your life, if these are new things, suddenly the people around you, you know, they don't really know what to expect, because initially they have an understanding of who you are based on your habits and how you show up. So one of the things that I write about briefly in this book is, you know, how do you create the time and space to have the conversations with the important people in your life about the changes you're making so that they can support you?
So that's where the support comes in. Would you be able to go through this and still maintain all the old relationships, or some relationships you just have to let go because the changes are so big, being in relationship with yourself?
I think that, you know, that's definitely something that occurred, that happened with me. You know, I think there's that interesting Jim Rohn quote that we are the average of the five people we spend time with. And the more you get into, you know, personal development and evolution and moving into a path of really living in a way that serves you and serves your greater good, which is whatever it is that you want to do in the world, your life's purpose, then you might find that some of the people you spend time with don't have the habits, don't have the behaviors, don't live in accordance with that once you've identified that. So then it's about figuring out whether or not the relationships are worth maintaining. So, you know, I noticed that with Buddhism too. You know, one of the tenets of Buddhism is to avoid gossiping, because gossiping doesn't serve anybody. And, you know, as a woman in this culture, gossiping is very prevalent. You know, look what she's wearing, or look, she's dating this younger man, or she's had plastic surgery, you know, that kind of stuff,
right.
You know? And
yeah.
Learning to separate from that, if you don't feel that that fits with who you are, is going to happen.
Right. Tasman, we're going to have to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to learn more from you about moving ahead with healthy habits.